Hello everyone, this is Dr. Sudhi Mohandas, the co-founder and managing director of iFirst International. Welcome to the program where we interview experts in the nonprofit and mission-based organization field. Today I have with me Rina Sarif, someone who I've known for a while and I find really interesting. Hi Rina.
Hi Dr. Sandeep.
Good to have you here. Today we're going to talk about something that is probably outside the normal conversation piece that people talk about, and that's about paid talent against volunteers. And when I talk about that, I really want to know in the sector that we're looking at, can you just explain a little bit more about the differences and maybe some similarities between these two?
Right. These days I've observed, being in human capital for a few years, so I see the evolution among the workforce. Instead of the percentage of paid talents being 100%, so now I see more of the paid talents also at the same time being involved with social projects. I would call them the new volunteers workforce. The difference between the paid talents and the volunteers is that they are actually can be categorized from three perspective. Number one is work. From the paid talent perspective, you're given contract of employment. Volunteers, you've been given volunteering agreement, you know, if you can call that. And then the difference between these both is that as a paid employee, we will give them job description, position, salary. But for volunteers, we do not give them all this, but we give them role instead of job description. In terms of hours, I would say that for the paid employees, we have stipulated hours, and for overtime, we are all paid. Some of them are paid for the non-executive. But for volunteers, there are flexibility in terms of the time that they can contribute. From the intention perspective, the paid employees are compensated by money, by cash, by perks. Volunteers are compensated by fulfillment, satisfaction, deeper than that. So that's where I see the differentiation, the distinct difference between paid employees and volunteers. Now, there are also similarities when you look at it from the dimension of psychological contract. Okay, when you talk about psychological contract, you're talking about how the mind perceive the contract between an entity and themselves. So there are similarities between paid employee and volunteers, because both of this category of people, their contract, their psychological of contract is the same commitment, because paid employee is working for an employer, volunteers are working for an entity. Yeah. In terms of organizational justice, also the same. I want to bring about to the perspective of managing them. Paid employees, they might be slight different, because the similarity between these both in terms of managing the paid employee and the volunteers, there are similarities in terms of managing their motivation. They're humans anyway, in terms of recognizing their potential, in terms of giving them reinforcement, in terms of yeah, that's all. But the difference is the tone of command. Mm. Because you must remember, the volunteers are actually taking effort, their own effort, to do this volunteerism. Yeah, for free. You know, it is just, they're driven by passion, driven by love, driven by their gratitude, driven by deep passion inside them to make a difference. You see?
Yeah. I just want to, since you mentioned that word about passion, that's so how is that different between somebody who has paid time? Because I've heard many people who work in corporates, they also say they're passionate about their job. And the people on volunteers also say they're passionate about their job. Yep. I mean, what would be the difference in that sense?
Passion, I would say passion would be different for individual. Yeah. You can be passionate in your work in an organization. You can also be passionate in terms of you serving the community. Yeah. So in terms of passion, the channel may be different. But what's inside the heart, I would say it's the same.
Okay.
Yeah, this is based on my own observation because I myself am involved as a paid employee, and I'm also involved in leading some social projects, environmental as well as a social work, charity work with humans and all that. So that's why I can see that in terms of passion, it is actually the same. I would say that. Yeah.
I was at a conference recently, and what was actually discussed, one lady actually raised the fact that she is a paid employee. Now she's also been asked to be a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that you do as
okay.
well, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But she's found out that the volunteering work takes more time, takes a lot more energy than actually what she does as a paid, you know. And yet, you know, she's struggling with, you know, wanting to do volunteer work and also being a paid employee.
Mm.
How does one actually manage this? I mean, you do this.
Yeah, I do that. And yes, there must be a balance between both. Very difficult to find the equilibrium between having to work as a paid employee and a volunteer. Let us understand from the perspective of psychology, the social exchange theory, if I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we in human capital, we when we work, we must understand the concept of why we work. Okay, so from the psychological perspective, a person's motivation can be conceptualized based on the social exchange policy, a social exchange theory. Meaning, in order for efforts to be sustained, rewards must exceed or at bare minimum balance out the cost or the output. Yeah, in another way is that the theory suggests that people contribute to the degree that they perceive that they are being rewarded. So when they perceive imbalance between contributions and rewards, and that individual is likely to resign, to bow out from volunteerism or to resign from an organization. Okay, so the social exchange theory describes six types of social rewards, meaning personal attraction, social acceptance, social approval, instrumental services, respect, prestige, self-satisfaction. In volunteering, rewards can take the form of learning, love, gratitude, as I've mentioned just now, perceive higher status associated with giving back to the community and an overall sense of positive spirituality. So someone who wants to be involved in volunteerism must have that deep, deep passion and that intrinsic autonomy inside themselves. Because if you want to get involved as a paid employee in volunteerism, but without the intrinsic autonomy, it's going to be really tough.
So it's a kind of a thin line, right?
The demarcation is quite thin.
Yeah. So there would be a situation whereby a volunteer, if they can't sustain being a volunteer, they start asking for compensation.
Yeah.
But is there a time where, for example, those who are moving, who are now board members, and I understand, you know, there are many of those people who sit in the board.
Yeah.
They actually are now volunteers.
Yeah, right.
And they've also got their paid talent.
Yeah.
How is it being a board and at the same time being a volunteer? Is there two different mindsets you have to have? If you're a paid talent and a volunteer, do you have to?
Yeah. To me, you must have purpose in life. Okay, whether you're a board or whether you're a lower non-executive, whether you're a technician or whether you are a social worker, whether you're a volunteer, you must have a purpose in life. And to me, as a leader in a corporate world and a volunteer, to me, it may differ with other people, but to me, the purpose is the same. The purpose as a corporate leader, being in a board of director, being in a boardroom, is to provide meaning to your surrounding. To provide meaning to your boundary, to your corporate, to your organization. And being a volunteer is to provide meaning to your environment. So life is all about providing meaning to your surrounding, the world. So to me, it is the same.
Okay.
Providing meaning to the world, providing meaning to the community, providing meaning to your segment that you're serving. Yeah.
Okay. And so and touched upon meaning. I know you're doing a lot of work that's providing meaning to you. You want to care to share a little bit of those things that you're doing that is providing meaning to you?
Right, right. For example, this is a very good example because in Tenaga, I am the head of talent acquisition. I provide meaning to people by advising them how to get a proper job, you know, career advice, how to enhance your career, how to move up the career ladder, how to advise the talent in terms of talent development, and how to advise a new breed of new millennials on how to secure a job. You know, my job in the corporate sector actually provide meaning to many segments of life. Now, on the other side, my life, being in the volunteerism, I'm leading the project for the Mumbai Owl Pencil Project. I am leading the project for the Slum Dwellers Education Project. I'm also the advisor for my daughter's YAs Global, where I went to Vietnam, Cambodia, and we have a project in Malaysia as well, and Indonesia, in finding people whom we can help and to call it volunteers. Yeah, I'm also in the Big Tulip movement as well, where we empower women, and I'm also a volunteer in Yayasan Chowkit as well. So my mission is to provide meaning to the people I'm serving. You see? So I am providing meaning in my corporate world as the GM of talent acquisition, and I'm also providing meaning in my world as a volunteer. I would say volunteer, not holding any position. Yeah, so providing meaning doesn't need to have position, actually. It's all from the heart. It is intrinsic autonomy. It is an intrinsic realization you must have to provide meaning to the world. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So again, I'd like to end this by asking a question that's been sitting in my head for a while. Do you grow to be a volunteer, or are you born volunteer?
Wow, this is awesome question, grow. I would say... Both. For me, I would say I am born a volunteer. Because my mom told me that since I was a kid, I was already giving out stuffs to, you know, the street kids, giving out stuffs to friends. And my mom was wondering, like, from small, you were already going to school and asking me to cook something extra for you to give out to your friends. So it was from little kid that I started to give. And so even a day will not pass. I don't feel comfortable if I don't give even 1 ringgit to the cleaner or to the guard, you know, things like that. So I would say it is born in me. But volunteerism can also grow, because for me, I now can influence people to start to get into the volunteering world by telling them, look, try out. Then you can feel... the purity of the heart. You can cleanse yourself by giving to other people. So actually there are two segments here. You can be born as a volunteer. You can also grow as a volunteer.
Excellent.
See? And especially in my capacity now that I've just won the award for the most influential global HR leader. So my role is actually to influence the people around me to do good deeds. So I took the opportunity of the award to actually encourage people to come and start to give to the society. And that's how I do it.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Rina, for sharing in a very short while a very insightful aspect of yourself and also the meaning of paid talent and volunteers. Thank
right,
you so
right.
much.
Oh, my welcome. Pleasure.
So there you have it. You've heard from Rina Sarif. Those of you who are interested in listening to this podcast, please visit www.ifirstinternational.com. Hi, this is Dr. Sudhir Mohandas, co-founder and managing director of iFirst International. Welcome to the program again. Today I have with me an esteemed colleague, somebody I've known for many decades, I guess. I have with me Brian Lee. Hi, Brian.
Hey, hi.
Good to have you here. Today we're going to be talking something about quite interesting, and that is, I guess if I put it in afterlife. For those people who have actually worked in a non-profit for a long period of time and have developed a certain way of thinking and all that, Brian has actually moved on after working for a non-profit. So Brian, good to have you again.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to ask you, you know, you've been working for a non-profit, and that was with WWF,
yes.
Right? And what was that transition for you after you had left and then you became an entrepreneur as to what you are now?
Initially, it was a bit challenging because the mindset of of working for a purpose is very different from the mindset of working for profit, right? And when I left, I took a few years to find my way, so to speak. Right? So I focus on things that I feel that is contributing to the society. In this case, it's education. And that's where I went into training, consulting, and corporate training. Right? And along the way, I was not very sure exactly where to focus on, because my thinking is, okay, we help people. Right? That's what I did in NGOs as well. Right? We help people. At the same time, corporate thinking is more towards ROI, effectiveness, efficiency, productivity. So the focus is more towards the perhaps the more material aspects rather than the more people-centric aspects. However, I found a nice balancing line whereby I focus on things that can make people happier at work, and indirectly that makes it more effective. Specifically, I focus on communications and productivity. So that includes things like stress management, those things like how you communicate with people. And I find that it's quite in line with what I felt when I was in an NGO, which is that whatever I do has a meaning to it, has a purpose to it.
And I guess that when that happened, was there some things you said, well, it's not going to work for me, the fact that I worked in an NGO, it's not going to work when I become an entrepreneur? Or were there some things you just felt, I can still carry this forward?
If my memory serves me right, as I remember, because memories, you're not very sure whether your memories are reliable or not, change over time. As I remember it, when I was in an NGO, in WF, as you know, I don't remember ever asking for a raise. Never. My thinking is, okay, I got this opportunity to serve. That's what's important for me. And leaving the NGO world, I started doing training for training providers. And so far, I've never asked any of the training provider to increase my fees. So even those training providers that I've been doing training for the last 6-7 years, that rate from 7 years ago, I have not asked them to increase the fees.
But is that a principle, or is that something that has come from the fact that you'd worked in a non-profit?
That's a good question. From how I see it, right? That's how I see the world, in the sense that, okay, I'm here to do something good, I got the opportunity, but that's what matters. Right? And I believe that if I'm effective at what I do, then the income will take care of itself. I mean, that's my thinking. Like. Of course, at the same time, I'm also very careful with living a simple life. Because as NGO, when you're in the NGO world, it's not like a lot of high salaries or whatever, right? So you keep life simple, be content with it. And that practice have been, that lifestyle has been with me even now. Sometimes it's out of practicality. For example, I'm very sensitive to environment. So I don't sleep on mattresses. Even when I go to hotels for training, right, I will sleep on the floor. And even at home now, I have a king size bed in my room, but I still sleep on the floor. Because it's something that I'm more comfortable with. So I suppose some is due to practical reasons. And some is due to the mindset from NGO, whereby you only spend what you really need to spend. I think that mindset has been carried on for the last 10, 15, 20 years.
And do you think, in many ways, this is something that is the new generation of people that are coming out into the workforce who are having this mindset that now I may be working as an entrepreneur, I may be working as a corporate, but there are some very fundamental working habits or culture that one adopts in a non-profit, like you just said, no polystyrene, or making sure that you really work within what your means are and all that. Is that slowly happening now in your experience, that you're seeing that, or it only happens to those people who are exposed to non-profits and then when they go out?
Every year I go to universities because I want to keep in touch with the university students, so I do programs for the university students. And I see a shift in the last, for example, about 6-7 years ago, I'll ask them, any of you do businesses while you're learning, you're being a student, and maybe you have a smattering of hands. Now, when you ask how many of you, about one third of the room will raise their hands. They say, oh, and their incomes ranges from say 300-400 ringgit a month to about 7,000-8,000 ringgit a month as a student. Eh? And as a result, when they keep in touch with me after they graduate, they'll tell me that, oh, I got job offers from 3 MNCs and all that stuff. And they'll just pick one, after 1 or 2 months, they'll leave. So I ask, hey, so why do you leave? You're such a big company. And the reason is that the amount of money that they're getting is less than what they're getting online from their Instagrams, from their MLM, whatever that they're doing, right? So to them, it's not so much about getting the position as a manager or whatever, not so much as getting a secure salary, but it's more for their experience. So they'll tell me, oh, I want to make a difference in this, or I want to explore this field. So it's no longer about the job security that we used to think about. No? And some of them tell me, oh, I want to do good. So they tell me, oh, I want to work for NGOs. But they're still practical though. Meaning they still ask, hey, how much do NGO people earn? No? And then when they find out, oh, it's so low. And, you know, so that practicality also is quite evident in their thinking. Just that they have a lot more thinking in terms of purpose.
So there is a shift in terms of the mindsets of the new generation. Perhaps that's also but let's take it to a scenario whereby you're now working in a non-urban area, a more rural setup, outside the city, and you did work, and I know you have, when you were working that time, you actually worked with the communities, and so they were either working with a non-profit organization in whatever capacity.
That's right.
At the same time, those people, they looked at working with a non-profit, but it was not a full-time job, right? Or maybe it was, I'm not so sure. But how does that work when it comes to people outside the city, when they actually worked for a non-profit and then now suddenly they move into a corporate world? Right? Do they still also adapt the same thing, or suddenly they become a different animal?
I really don't know, because the last time I was working in rural communities was about 10 years ago. So I have no idea how it has changed so far. And my context currently are more in the urban area, so I can't really answer that.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, it would be useful to actually understand that part. But how is it now in your life, that now that you have now come out, have you kind of developed a hybrid model whereby you take a lot of what you actually learned and gained from a non-profit into your own business, or is it everything is looking at ROI or the profit?
That's a very interesting aspect to look at, because I've been training a lot of different companies, and the feedback from participants when we have tea breaks and lunch and that is that they are more willing to leave the company if they find that their well-being is not taken care of, meaning that if they're too stressed, they're willing to just pack and go, right? And the mindset is not so much as I'm worried about losing my job. It's more like, hey, I'll lose my job, just that it's more inconvenient. I'd rather not be so inconvenienced, right? And as a result, right, when I look at the business point of view, it seems that the focus on the people part is much, much more intense now. So I suspect that, my personal opinion, right, is that the shift, right, between what I used to do in NGO and now, is that now my thinking is more flexible. It's not so much in boxes, so to speak. And that's, I attribute it to NGO training as well, because in NGOs we have so little resources. So we have to think out of the box and, okay, fine, what can we do? You know, what can we do this, what can we do that? And how to get things done in the non-traditional way. And I see that in corporates right now as well. Even managers I talk to, they start to think, okay, what else can I do compared to the past SOPs and protocols that they have? I see that happening. And I suppose that is similar to NGO world, whereby we have to make do with what we have. So let's just get creative. Yeah.
Okay. So my final question here is supposing you had to make a U-turn and go back, what would you change or what would you bring?
Can you go back to NGO?
Yeah.
As an employee
yeah.
in an
yeah.
NGO?
Yeah.
Okay.
Supposing somewhere down the line you had to make a U-turn, go back. What would you bring back and saying that, you know, there are some things that need to be changed because, you know, for whatever. Assuming that when you left, it still exists right now.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
So
okay.
There's no time.
Okay.
What would you think that there's something that you like to introduce back? That you wouldn't have gained when you were actually a non-profit. Is there anything?
One of the things that I would do differently is that I notice in corporates now, there's a lot of emphasis on collaboration. In many ways, it's a lot of emphasis, a lot more than in NGO world. And although in the NGO circle we say that, oh, we collaborate with government, we collaborate with this and that, the level of collaboration is very different in corporate. Corporate is like really, really collaborating. And I think that would be one of the things I would focus on a lot. Not so much as, okay, we have this agency in the government, we so-called collaborate in air quotes. In the business world, it's really collaboration, meaning that, okay, I know that this is your forte, this is your work, your profit area. How can I make more money by collaborating with you without going into your circle? Right? I see that a lot nowadays.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Brian, for your insights and your experiences that you've shared. Well, this is Dr. Sudhir Bondas signing off. Thank you very much. If you're very interested in listening more to the podcast, please visit www.ifirstinternational.com. Hello everyone, this is Dr. Sudhir Mohandas from iFirst International. I'm the Managing Director and Co-Founder. Welcome to the program again. I have with me an old friend, Ulrika Brunner. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sudhir.
So, Ulrika is basically the Country Director for Inspire Group Malaysia. And she's with me to talk about something rather interesting, and that's on this whole issue about CSR, or even people call it SR, I think, right? So let's start off by first talking about the first question I have here, and that is, we have heard so much about CSR or CR in the past. Has the effort now died a natural death, or has it evolved? I mean, I don't hear much about it right now. So maybe you'd like to just share a little bit about that.
Right, so Dr. Sid, if I can, from my personal experience and, you know, being in the corporate world, the sort of difference and the changes that I've seen is, yes, initially it was sort of a bit like a fad, like the companies would have to have some sort of CSR activity to show off or, you know, part of their KPIs. And I think it's evolved in, I would say, the past 10 years, in my experience, that the companies will try to find something that makes sense within their scope, so whether it's within their business or for their staff. And ultimately, most recently, from what I've seen, it has become more like a responsible business conduct. So you're not just doing it to tick a box, but the companies are actually trying to find something that makes sense in the area that they're operating on. So whether that is the industry, making sure that they are responsible environmentally, economically, as well as with social progress where they can touch. And I think that's a positive development. So maybe it's moved to, yeah, this CSR or CR that you were saying, to being responsible business conduct, and I think that's very positive, because
right,
I think
right.
also it means that they actually become more involved in the social network where they can actually have an impact.
So you mentioned it can be quite positive. Are there experiences that you've gone through where it hasn't been positive, or
I think
it's always positive whenever you do CSR?
I think the idea is always positive. The intention is, it's great that the intention is there, but very often the actual playing out of it is not maybe as powerful as it should be. that it's more like ticking a box, that it's not really thinking, oh, you know, what real impact is this causing?
So I'd like to ask you about this ticking the box.
Yeah.
I mean, why is that, why does that normally happen? I mean, why is it because of regulations, or is it really coming from the heart of an organization?
So that's where I think the ticking of the box is not the heart of the organization. And that's where I think it needs to move from ticking the box, which has limited passion or actual dedication from a corporation and the individuals in it, to responsible business conduct, where you are actually concerned and you want to do the right thing. So when I say ticking the box, it's basically because a corporation feels that they should be doing something, and that it becomes maybe much more diluted. Like, well, they'll say, this weekend we're going to go and paint a school in our local neighborhood. And then what happens after that? Are we really following up with that school? Are we creating any sort of relationship with the participants, like with the staff of the company? Is there an engagement on a personal level? Because I believe that unless you have that passion and personal, you're investing personally in it and not expecting anything in return, I'm not sure I really believe that you're doing it for the right reasons.
Right. And who do you think is the real beneficiary? Is it the company that's doing the work, or the NGO or non-profit that is receiving that benefit?
Yeah, so my personal opinion is that if you do handouts, like you just come there and give them something for free,
a hamper or a gift.
Yeah, I don't believe you're really helping.
Helping who?
Helping the recipient.
Right.
Right? Unless you're actually creating something of value for them, a takeaway for them that they can build on, whether that is knowledge, education, or, I mean, a school is creating a good environment, it's good, but to make sure that that school, that building can continue to operate, for example, that's much more powerful than just coming and painting a few walls. But for the company, again, it's, you know, from them, many companies might find that just going there is already good enough for them, because they're just ticking that box.
Right, right.
And they're not looking maybe for what a meaningful contribution.
That's very interesting. So what is it that is so pertinent that will get the corporate sector to get involved in the social environmental causes? I mean, what makes them get into this area?
From my perspective, it's very much about the individuals that are involved in it. So in the corporation, for example, the leaders in that corporation.
Mm.
So you have the CEO, the C-suites, the people that are leading the engagement. And how actively participative are they? Are they really giving themselves? Are they seen as being passionate about this action, this cause that the company is involved in? Or are they taking a backseat? Are they the first ones to step up and lead everybody else and show, like, this is something that is important and let's do this together? Or are they not bothering to turn up?
So from what I'm understanding, what you're just saying, it has to be at the top.
I think so.
So I understand that many of this falls under human resources.
Exactly.
So how does this work? Will it ever work?
I believe that you will never get the full impact of it. You will get small pieces, bite size.
Hmm.
But I think, you know, as I'm now building a company, etc., what I would hope to do is something that actually creates a long-term benefit for all parties involved. Because I believe that all of us would like to give back, right? I mean, I think that's a human instinct, right? And if you can do that in a way that creates meaning, you see you can actually contribute without expecting anything in return, that is so powerful. And so to build that sort of environment that you are doing it because you want to do it, but you're not just doing it once. It's something that is part of, yeah, it's your passion, and you want to keep on doing it.
So if I'm a leader of an NGO or a non-profit, I should visit and speak to the CEO of a company instead of somebody else, because they would be the pulse and the heart to to the impact?
I think from my experience, any major collaboration that you want to do with a corporation, you have to have the top buy-in.
Okay.
And then internally in that corporation, it's usually important that the rest of the teams see that the top has bought into it and are invested into it. Do you know what I mean?
I understand.
It can't just be that there's a division that's passionate about it. Then it will never be as big as it could be.
Okay.
You could still do things, but I think it's just the extent of the impact of it may be limited.
Okay. And so are the nonprofits under the nonprofit sector now facing competition or challenges from the corporate and like-minded people who are now taking on causes and issues on the ground by themselves? I mean, is there now this issue whereby, okay, we're not going to do CS, we're not going to do CSR, but let's do it our own way, you know? Is this now becoming an issue for the nonprofits or what's your views on that?
I think if you are involved in a cause and it's something that you have, if you are an NGO that you're dealing with a cause that you're looking at a long-term effect, I think that's a perfect possibility of collaboration with corporations because they have also limited resources, right?
Mm.
And they want to make sure that if they are invested into a project or they want to be involved in something, they want to be doing that with the brightest minds that know what is going on in that area. If you say you want to help refugees, for example, I as a corporation would prefer to work with an NGO who knows what they're doing in that area rather than me having to reinvent the wheel. So I think there's an opportunity for collaboration. So there has to be, I believe, there has to be a lot of conversations and also trying to find, for the NGO to try to find the right corporate fit. And that again, speaking to the C-suites, I think it all has to do with how you connect with people, right? But, finding the people that have a similar target or a similar idea of what they want to achieve, and when that sinks, I think that would be beautiful because you have the people that really know what's going on the ground with the NGO and the corporations that have the instinct of wanting to make a difference. I think that's very powerful. So, no, I don't believe that the NGOs are...
Right. But what about this issue about... I'm quite aware that many corporates have a heart and they want to do something. So they set up foundations or they set up something that will address the cause that they want to do, right? What's your thoughts about that?
Of course, there's going to be leaders, I think, that want to do that. They might want to leave their mark.
Right. Some legacy and all that.
Yes.
Right. So if I was working, if I was an NGO and I do recognize that many corporates out there want to do CSR, what would you say would be some of the ways I should pitch myself to the corporate that they'll say, yes, we want to help you? Do you have an idea?
I really think it's connecting with, so if an NGO is dealing with a cause that can be relatable to the corporation, whether that is economical in their area where they operate, or environmental, or for social progress. If you can connect with an area that makes sense for the corporation, and that corporation has a foundation, I don't see why can't you work together.
Right.
But there has to be that connect, I think, that it makes sense. I think with the corporations today, I think they're looking for that meaningful contribution that makes sense also in the area that they operate, whether it's the industry or geographical area, but to really be able to contribute. And there, I think the NGOs that know that the corporations are there have an opportunity to connect with them.
Well, thank you very much, Ulrika. I mean, there was excellent insight and a lot of wisdom and advice on how the NGOs and CSRs can actually work together on the same ecosystem. Well, excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Siddique. My pleasure.
So, All of you guys out there who like to listen to this podcast, please visit www.ifirstinternational.com. This is Dr. Sudhi Mohandas signing off. Hello everyone, this is Dr. Sudhi Mohandas from iFirst International. I am the Managing Director and Co-Founder. Today I have with me in the program Ashwin Nair, who is the President of Recruiters Malay Association Malaysia, RAM, that's the abbreviation. Welcome, Ashwin.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
So we have today an interesting topic, and we're going to be talking about the issue in connection with the mission. And I would like to hear from you, Ashwin, about really about your organization and why do you have such an NGO looking at recruitment? Maybe you'd like to share.
Okay, first of all, thank you so much for your time, Doctor. Okay, today, now first of all, let me explain to you. Recruiters Association Malaysia is actually generally an umbrella for a collaboration between recruiters and candidates. The main purpose of this, why is the association being formed? Because these days there is a gap between candidates and recruiters. So what we are looking at right now is to fill this gap by having the association. Now, this gap has been caused because of too many job portals in the market. So the association comes in as to maintain as a single umbrella so that candidates and recruiters can come together and work together to get to make sure they get the right jobs. So that's mainly what is our vision is all about.
That's interesting. So am I correct to say that your organization is the only organization in Malaysia that works in this way, or as an NGO, or there are others?
No, so far at this juncture, this is the only NGO for recruiters. In terms of recruiters, this is the only NGO. But in terms of HR personnel, there are their own personal associations. But I believe for the HRs, in terms of the HR association, they are more focused towards the HR personnel and not towards more towards the public. So they're more towards their internal employees or internal people, members, focusing on their upskilling and things like that. So
but they are a business, right?
They are an NGO as well.
An NGO as well. That's interesting. Okay. But your organization has built its traction. How long have you been established now for?
Unofficially, it has been around for the past 1.5 years. Officially, we are currently still in the midst of getting ROS register, so this would take another 3 to 6 months.
Okay.
So this is in progress with ROS, but we have already been running workshops for public, getting homeless attraction, B40 groups. So these are the kind of activities that we have done in terms of, so we focus about 6 topics in total. Usually will be CV workshop, how do you prepare your CV end to end, on how do you prepare yourself pre-interview, post-interview, and then how do you do branding in terms of branding of social media, on what kind of things that you can write, where should you be on, and which social media you should be looking for jobs apart from job portals. We also guide them in terms of job portals on where they should get, where they can apply for jobs. And the other note that we also cover is how they should get to know about networking events and the kind of target of networking events they should target for. So this is what we are doing.
So how does that make your organization any different from other NGOs or similar kind of organizations? So, I mean, why, if I was a talent looking for a job, or I'm looking to be counseled or coached or whatever, why would I come to your organization?
Because at the end of the day, what is currently happening out in the market is more focused towards placing the candidate. It's no longer service-oriented. The industry is supposed to be more of service-oriented, but it's no longer focused towards the candidate. It's just more towards focusing on the client. So 90% of the recruitment firms in this country are actually focusing on the clients instead of the candidates. So these days, candidates themselves get lost. The moment you park them in their role, they actually don't know how to go about, and they're not comfortable to even speak up. Why? Because we have built the barriers in them. So why RAM comes in is because to help these people to actually prepare themselves from before a job right until after they get a job. So how do they keep themselves up to date? They should start building their own branding. They should focus on building their own brand. 90% of Malaysians, the moment you pull them out from their position, they don't have a self-branding. And this is something that is lacking very badly. And sadly, because of this issue, to a point companies are getting impacted because at the end of the day businesses are not coming in. And it's all a chain cycle. But candidates doesn't seem to understand why, because they are not being educated. Sadly, I would say universities are supposed to actually guide them all this, which is, it barely takes about a week before they get out of their final semester. Universities should take the initiative to actually guide these candidates, but they are not. So that's where RAM comes in to do these kind of preparations. So that's where we do it on our own free time basis to help them out. Sometimes we do it on a one-to-one basis, sometimes we do group discussions. So this is what we do on a time-to-time. So the last one was done in Saito College, and also I have done this week 2 one-to-one sessions. So that's basically. And then my board members as well has their own one-to-one sessions with candidates as well.
And so most of your focus is on your candidates are university leavers.
Not exactly. We focus on all level candidates. That means you're talking about from junior level up all the way to senior level to board members. The reason being because I think no one has actually made the expectation right or made them really understand what are recruiters looking at. So in order for you to get hired, what is recruiters looking at, what is required, recruiters looking at in terms of the CV, what are the layouts they expect, no one has made the public understand what do they really want.
I had a conversation with a previous person who I've invited to the podcast about a week ago, and I was talking to him about the fact that, about these issues about talent, and I proposed to him this view that shouldn't we also be looking at training the career counselors training people in general, even parents, about what to do so that, you know, because a lot of these parents also work in certain positions and hold things and all that. Is that something to consider to explore, or is that just asking too much?
I would say that in that method, in terms of training parents, trust me, I don't think so we actually have time to actually look into it. But there is a reverse method to this. Why don't we get people, every industry or every single, let's say example, you're training, let's say you're doing a degree in human resource. Every university should get a product specialist. That means get someone from the workforce, maybe once a month, to come in and review syllabus, sit down with the lecturers to review the syllabus, review what should be taught, what should not be taught, can we explain to them what is reality. See, all this should be done. Today we have career, as how you said, career counselors, or let's say even lecturers for themselves, they're only sitting between the four walls. So they don't actually know what's really happening in the industry. So it's becoming a challenge because they're only teaching by the book. And unfortunately, these students are becoming robotic. So it doesn't solve industry's issues. So at the end of the day, industry would opt for people who has not educated themselves, would prefer without having a degree. Why? Because that chap or that girl would have grown from scratch and learn everything, compared to someone going to university and sitting down there and learning everything by the book and not knowing what is reality.
And so what is the, in your, from your experience, some of the glaring mistakes or issues where a lot of these people, when they come to visit you, when they're looking for jobs, what are some of those things that are very glaring that should have been corrected much earlier in their university life or in their career life?
I would say the most basic thing before even meeting anyone is actually your resume. Okay? Now, a lot of people don't actually understand when, if you see 90% of the resumes that you receive these days, they actually write a summary of themselves, but not related to what they have done in the past. But they are trying to cross-sell themselves by saying that their attitude, they are hardworking, they accept challenges, they accept this, they accept that. But at the end of the day, they are not highlighting what have they achieved, what have they done, how many years are they in what industry. Nobody has actually taught them to actually do this. You know, a summary is supposed to be to give a brief introduction of who you are in a whole nutshell, of how many years of industry experience do you have, which industry have you covered. That's the point of a summary.
And so on a reverse angle, the person who's looking at the resumes, have they been trained how to look at resumes? Because you may have done all what you've just said, and as I understand it, a lot of these people who are in the point of recruiting, they take less than a minute to pick out, you know, if at all. have they been trained to know what they're supposed to look for? Well, has some alignment been made?
You see, the most important thing, most of them, it's either being trained or not. That's a big question mark. But I believe if they are with a recruitment firm, they are being trained. But internal people who are actually hired for internal companies, like let's say they are a recruiter for internal base, they may not be trained. Why? Because like recruitment firm, the reason why I say they are being trained is because they have a high level of expectations in terms of clients. So it's very focused towards keywords. Okay, in a very simple understanding, a good CV has the right keywords that is focusing on their industry experience. That's it. Now, 90% of candidates, they end up writing an essay. That's not what recruiters are looking at. That's not what employers are looking at. Now, as an employer, I'll probably just have 5 minutes to review your CV. That's about it. I do not have more than that. So if you're going to write a lengthy explanation, nobody will understand. So keep it short, simple. I'll just give a very, very simple brief introduction of what a CV should actually have in a very simple manner. The first thing starts with your personal information introduction. Keep it short and simple. Your name, your contact number, your city and state, and then followed by your highest qualification. That's it. Finish. Move on to summary. Summary is where you write your overall industry experience. How many years in what industry and what have you done? That means, as an example, if you have been a HR manager for 10 years, right there, you've been a HR manager for 10 years and you have covered, example, recruitment or a full spectrum of HR. That's it. Keep it short, simple on the summary section. Then move on towards your what have you done, how have you achieved in your industry? What have you done differently from the others? Why should I hire you instead of hiring B? That's the next thing. Following after that is where you focus on your experience. You start with your last company's name, your designation title, and your duration. These three things. Then explaining briefly about what is your last role all about. Keep it maximum at 5 to 6 lines. That's it. After once you have completed all the companies that you have input, at the bottom, write a section where you write their skills. Now, skills is where it requires a lot of research to be done. Every single position will have its own skill sets that are required. Example, when you say someone who is doing customer service, they have people management, they have, you know, they have service, they have managing a client. See, there are keywords for this. We don't actually go and write down, okay, my task as a customer service is to manage clients. No, it's a keyword. So you have to find and research, you have to do a research of what are the keywords for your industry. Focus on all those keywords. The reason why I'm saying, because how a recruiter looks for a good CV is by putting in the keywords that what the client wants. What are the skill set the client wants? The moment they put in the skill set, your CVs will come up.
So it's basically an eyeball thing.
Correct.
I hear your point, and that's very useful. I just want to, because we're running with time, I just want to check, ask you this point. You've done a lot of work over the period of time, and you would have collected a lot of data. Also research. All those data and research, would that come forward for the benefit of society and all that at some point?
In terms of, yes, the research has been done between recruiters on what are the key industries that requires assistance and what actually needs focus on. We will not be actually extending the data out to anyone yet at this juncture, but we are using the data to actually come up with a system right now, which is also solving challenges in the recruitment industry and also the challenges for candidates. So one of the simple things like challenges in a candidate for candidates are because there's too many portals. So we are getting one system to be associated with the association. So that's going to be the main priority system for recruiters. So if they're looking for talent, that's going to be the system. In terms of solving recruiters issues is where candidates does not turn up and attitude and challenges and all that in the industry. We're actually coming up with a feedback system. So it's going to be a two-way feedback system where recruiters or HR or hiring managers can go into the system and put in a feedback about a candidate. Automatically an email will be generated over to the candidate for them to go and justify their feedback. So two parties goes in and gives their feedback. This is also to curb the challenges for the recruiters and also the industry. So we're focusing on both parties right now. So that's what we're looking at. So this is one of the initiatives that I'm doing.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Aswin, for sharing your recipe for success, as well as what are the, some of the things or highlights to make a change? I'm sure those who are listening to this podcast will definitely benefit and probably get in touch with you. Well, with that, thank you once again, Ashwin.
Sure. Thank you so much, Doctor. Thank you for your time.
So with that, those who are interested in actually listening to this podcast, please visit www.ifirstinternational.com. Hello everyone, this is Dr. Sudhi Mohandas from iFirst International. I am the Managing Director and Co-Founder. Today I have with me in the program Ashwin Nair, who is the President of Recruiters Malay Association Malaysia, RAM, that's the abbreviation. Welcome, Ashwin.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
So we have today an interesting topic, and we're going to be talking about the issue in connection with the mission. And I would like to hear from you, Ashwin, about really about your organization and why do you have such an NGO looking at recruitment? Maybe you'd like to share.
Okay, first of all, thank you so much for your time, Doctor. Okay, today, now first of all, let me explain to you. Recruiters Association Malaysia is actually generally an umbrella for a collaboration between recruiters and candidates. The main purpose of this, why is the association being formed? Because these days there is a gap between candidates and recruiters. So what we are looking at right now is to fill this gap by having the association. Now, this gap has been caused because of too many job portals in the market. So the association comes in as to maintain as a single umbrella so that candidates and recruiters can come together and work together to get to make sure they get the right jobs. So that's mainly what is our vision is all about.
That's interesting. So am I correct to say that your organization is the only organization in Malaysia that works in this way, or as an NGO, or there are others?
No, so far at this juncture, this is the only NGO for recruiters. In terms of recruiters, this is the only NGO. But in terms of HR personnel, there are their own personal associations. But I believe for the HRs, in terms of the HR association, they are more focused towards the HR personnel and not towards more towards the public. So they're more towards their internal employees or internal people, members, focusing on their upskilling and things like that. So
but they are a business, right?
They are an NGO as well.
An NGO as well. That's interesting. Okay. But your organization has built its traction. How long have you been established now for?
Unofficially, it has been around for the past 1.5 years. Officially, we are currently still in the midst of getting ROS registered. So this would take another 3 to 6 months.
Okay.
So this is in progress with ROS. But we have already been running workshops for public, getting homeless attraction, B40 groups. So these are the kind of activities that we have done in terms of... So we focus about 6 topics in total. Usually will be CV workshop, how do you prepare your CV end-to-end, on how do you prepare yourself pre-interview, post-interview, and then how do you do branding in terms of branding of social media, on what kind of things that you can write, where should you be on, and which social media you should be looking for jobs apart from job portals. We also guide them in terms of job portals on where they should get, where they can apply for jobs. And the other note that we also cover is how they should get to know about networking events and the kind of target of networking events they should target for. So this is what we are doing.
So how does that make your organization any different from other NGOs or similar kind of organizations? So, I mean, why, if I was a talent looking for a job, or I'm looking to be counseled or coached or whatever, why would I come to your organization?
Because at the end of the day, what is currently happening out in the market is more focused towards placing the candidate. It's no longer service-oriented. The industry is supposed to be more of service-oriented, but it's no longer focused towards the candidate. It's just more towards focusing on the client. So 90% of the recruitment firms in this country are actually focusing on the clients instead of the candidates. So these days, candidates themselves get lost. The moment you park them in their role, they actually don't know how to go about, and they're not comfortable to even speak up. Why? Because we have built that barriers in them. So why RAM comes in is because to help these people to actually prepare themselves from before a job right until after they get a job. So how do they keep themselves up to date? They should start building their own branding. They should focus on building their own brand. 90% of Malaysians, the moment you pull them out from their position, they don't have a self-branding. And this is something that is lacking very badly. And sadly, because of this issue, to a point, companies are getting impacted because at the end of the day, businesses are not coming in. And it's all a chain cycle. But candidates doesn't seem to understand why, because they are not being educated. Sadly, I would say universities are supposed to actually guide them all this, which is, it barely takes about a week before they get out of their final semester. Universities should take the initiative to actually guide these candidates, but they are not. So that's where RAM comes in to do these kind of preparations. So that's where we do it on our own free time basis to help them out. Sometimes we do it on a one-to-one basis, sometimes we do group discussions. So this is what we do on a time-to-time. So the last one was done in Saito College, and also I have done this week 2 one-to-one sessions. So that's basically. And then my board members as well has their own one-to-one sessions with candidates as well.
And so most of your focus is on your candidates are university leavers.
Not exactly. We focus on all level candidates. That means you're talking about from junior level up all the way to senior level to board members. The reason being because I think no one has actually made the expectation right or made them really understand what are recruiters looking at. So in order for you to get hired, what is recruiters looking at, what is required, the recruiters looking at in terms of the CV, what are the layouts they expect. No one has made the public understand what do they really want.
I had a conversation with a previous person who I've invited to the podcast about a week ago. And I was talking to him about the fact that, about these issues about talent. And I proposed to him this view that shouldn't we also be looking at training the career counselors training people in general, even parents, about what to do so that, you know, because a lot of these parents also work in certain positions and hold things and all that. Is that something to consider to explore, or is that just asking too much?
I would say that in that method, in terms of training parents, trust me, I don't think so we actually have time to actually look into it. But there is a reverse method to this. Why don't we get people, every industry or every single, let's say example, you're training, let's say you're doing a degree in human resource. Every university should get a product specialist. That means get someone from the workforce, maybe once a month, to come in and review syllabus, sit down with the lecturers to review the syllabus, review what should be taught. What should not be taught? Can we explain to them what is reality? See, all this should be done. Today we have career, as how you said, career counselors, or let's say even lecturers for themselves, they are only sitting between the four walls. So they don't actually know what's really happening in the industry. So it's becoming a challenge because they're only teaching by the book. And unfortunately, these students are becoming robotic. So it doesn't solve industry's issues. So at the end of the day, industry would opt for people who has not educated themselves, would prefer without having a degree. Why? Because that chap or that girl would have grown from scratch and learn everything, compared to someone going to university and sitting down there and learning everything by the book and not knowing what is reality.
And so what is the, in your, from your experience, some of the glaring mistakes or issues where a lot of these people, when they come to visit you, when they're looking for jobs, what are some of those things that are very glaring that should have been corrected much earlier in their university life or in their career life?
I would say the most basic thing before even meeting anyone is actually your resume. Okay? Now, a lot of people don't actually understand when, if you see 90% of the resumes that you receive these days, they actually write a summary of themselves, but not related to what they have done in the past, but they are trying to cross-sell themselves by saying that their attitude, they are hardworking, they accept challenges, they accept this, they accept that. But at the end of the day, they are not highlighting what have they achieved, what have they done, how many years are they in what industry. Nobody has actually taught them to actually do this. You know, a summary is supposed to be to give a brief introduction of who you are in a whole nutshell, of how many years of industry experience do you have, which industry have you covered. That's the point of a summary.
And so on a reverse angle, the person who's looking at the resumes,
Have they been trained how to look for at resumes? Because you may have done all what you just said, and as I understand it, a lot of these people who are in the point of recruiting, they take less than a minute to pick out, you know, if at all. Have they been trained to know what they're supposed to look for? Has there some alignment been made?
You see, the most important thing, most of them is either being trained or not. That's a big question mark. But I believe if they are with a recruitment firm, they are being trained. But internal people who are actually hired for internal companies, like let's say they are a recruiter for internal base, they may not be trained. Why? Because like recruitment firm, the reason why I say they are being trained is because they have a high level of expectations in terms of clients. So it's very focused towards keywords. Okay. In a very simple understanding, a good CV has the right keywords that is focusing on their industry experience. That's it. Now, 90% of candidates, they end up writing an essay. That's not what recruiters are looking at. That's not what employers are looking at. Now, as an employer, I'll probably just have 5 minutes to review your CV. That's about it. I do not have more than that. So if you're going to write a lengthy explanation, nobody would understand. So keep it short, simple. I'll just give a very, very simple, brief introduction of what a CV should actually have in a very simple manner. The first thing starts with your personal information introduction. Keep it short and simple. Your name, your contact number, your city and state, and then followed by your highest qualification. That's it. Finish. Move on to summary. Summary is where you write your overall industry experience. How many years in what industry and what have you done? That means as an example, if you have been a HR manager for 10 years, right there, you've been an HR manager for 10 years and you have powered, example, recruitment or a full spectrum of HR. That's it. Keep it short, simple on the summary section. Then move on towards your, what have you done? How have you achieved in your industry? What have you done differently from the others? Why should I hire you instead of hiring B? That's the next thing. Following after that is where you focus on your experience. You start with your last company's name, your designation title, and your duration. These three things. Then explaining briefly about what is your last role all about. Keep it maximum at 5 to 6 lines. That's it. After once you have completed all the companies that you have input, at the bottom, write a section where you write their skills. Now, skills is where it requires a lot of research to be done. Every single position will have its own skill sets that are required. Example, when you say someone who is doing customer service, they have people management, they have, you know, they have service, they are managing a client. See, there are keywords for this. We don't actually go and write down, okay, my task as a customer service is to manage clients. No, it's a keyword. So you have to find and research, you have to do a research of what are the keywords for your industry. Focus on all those keywords. The reason why I'm saying, because how a recruiter looks for a good CV is by putting in the keywords that what the client wants. What are the skill set the client wants? The moment they put in the skill set, your CVs will come up.
So it's basically an eyeball thing.
Correct.
I hear your point, and that's very useful. I just want to, because we're running with time, I just want to check, ask you this point. You've done a lot of work over the period of time, and you would have collected a lot of data. Also research. As all those data and research, would that come forward for the benefit of society and all that at some point?
In terms of yes, the research has been done between recruiters on what are the key industries that requires assistance and what actually needs focus on. We will not be actually extending the data out to anyone yet at this juncture, but we are using the data to actually come up with a system right now, which is also solving challenges in the recruitment industry and also the challenges for candidates. So one of the simple things like challenges in a candidate for candidates are because there's too many portals. So we are getting one system to be associated with the association. So that's going to be the main priority system for recruiters. So if they're looking for talent, that's going to be the system. In terms of solving recruiters' issues is where candidates does not turn up and attitude and challenges and all that in the industry. We're actually coming up with a feedback system. So it's going to be a two-way feedback system where recruiters or HR or hiring managers can go into the system and put in a feedback about a candidate. Automatically, an email will be generated over to the candidate for them to go and justify their feedback. So two parties goes in and gives their feedback. This is also to curb the challenges for the recruiters and also the industry. So we're focusing on both parties right now. So that's what we're looking at. So this is one of the initiatives that I'm doing.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Aswin, for sharing your recipe for success, as well as what are some of the things of highlights to make a change. I'm sure those who are listening to this podcast will definitely benefit and probably get in touch with you. Well, with that, thank you once again, Aswin.
Sure. Thank you so much, Doctor. Thank you for that.
So with that, those who are interested in actually listening to this podcast, please visit www.ifirstinternational.com.